The American scene, wherever it is a discipline of anthropology, the study of man and the behavior of man. You have here in Alaska a very distinguished anthropologist, Dr. William J. Loynes, who is professor of anthropology at the University of Alaska. And we've asked him, a man who's been in Alaska for some 16 years now and thoroughly familiar with all parts of it, we've asked him to address himself to a topic, maybe that he's shifted his thoughts a little bit. We'll permit you that liberty, Bill. We've asked him to address himself to the educational base of the modern Alaskan economy, or the connection between the levels of education and economic development as it is in prospect here in Alaska. Dr. Loy.
Thank you, John. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I was very pleased to hear Mr. Marshall end his talk on the note of the priority of the Alaska Native problem and the educational configurations and the educational implication of this particular problem. Now, when I was asked to address you, I retorted that I was an anthropologist and that we have a very peculiar way of looking at the world and that we're not easily changed either. So I said, by my training and by my studies, I am mostly familiar with the Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut cultures and with the problems that are today confronting these cultures and these groups. And so I would like to address myself to the problems connected with education in rural Alaska. And again, going back to what Mr. Marshall said, that we have to assess the needs, that we have to obviously establish the universe of needs, that we have to look upon our resources and see what we can do. But I would certainly say that there is no use talking about the future unless we know what's wrong with the past and the present. Because if we just simply keep on rolling the old wagon downhill, it's going to get stuck pretty fast in some ruts. And so I would say that speaking about the educational base for rural Alaska and for rural Alaska as it is passing and changing into modern Alaska, it will be my thesis that without new directions and radical changes in the educational system and in the environment in which we educate, the socioeconomic environment, the health environment, the housing environment, the total educational picture, unless we have new directions and new radical changes, there will not be a modern Alaska for the 60 or 70,000 Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts of the next 10, 15 years. Because exactly as Mr. Marshall said, there will be a very, very strong urbanization and there will be a fringe. And unless we radically change things, we will be condemning the first Alaskans to the fringe. Well, now we hear much in Alaska about educating the Alaska Native. It is a main topic of conversation wherever I go. And the fact that people lump all these Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts into one category and call them the Native indicates already to me that they are on dangerous ground as far as education is concerned. You know, the Alaska Native is an abstraction. The white man is an abstraction. I can line up for you here against the wall people that are of North Indian extraction, Iraqi extraction, Finnish, Irish, Afrikaners of South Africa, Mexicans of Spanish descent, and they're all white men. Because we have here a categorization that's based upon race. And race has never yet told you anything about what a person believes, what he thinks, what he talks, what his value system is, and so forth. Now, you might say, well, we're only speaking about Alaska. I submit to you that prior to modern communication, a Haida of Southeast Alaska had no idea of the existence, let alone of the value system, of a Kopuk Eskimo. They were two totally different people, even if they were and are members of the same Mongoloid race. And so race obviously is not sufficient to identify or explain a people or their language, their religion, their psychology, their attitudes, and so forth. And a few behavioral traits are not sufficient either to characterize any group of people. So the question for us in our, or for our purposes here today, in an educational framework, is to ask ourselves, can we really treat the Alaska Natives as one group and use one system, one approach, one administrative framework, and so forth? Well, anthropologists and psychologists have tried to find some kind of modal behavior or even a modal personality for various ethnic groups, and I have found it always to be an extremely complex endeavor and one that resulted in very, very few firm results. It appears, however, that if you have a very, very small group that is rather homogeneous in history and has been subject to the same continuing influences, that you then can fairly well describe some kind of a modal behavior. And then you can pretty well say that most people of this particular small homogeneous group behave that way. But I submit to you that the Alaskan peoples, Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts, are not homogeneous in origin, or not homogeneous in language, or not homogeneous in cultural history. They have not been subject to the same continuing influences, neither from their physical nor from their social environment. And so it is my contention that there are true and serious regional differences which should be taken into account when we speak of education, when we speak of, quotes, integrating, ends of quotes, these people, leading these people into the mainstream of urbanized, highly skilled, high technological developments in Alaska. Let's take a look at some regional differences. The Southeast Alaskans, Tlingit and Haida, have been guided and supported and bound by very, very strong clans, by very, very strong family feelings, by a very strong political structure that was based upon those family feelings and clan structures. They had a very strong hierarchical political structure. Because of this, they developed a very, very strong sense of tradition, a very strong sense of pride, rightful sense of pride in their tradition. They had money even before Columbus ever stumbled across this continent. And as you know, Christopher Columbus was pretty much like many of us are here today. When he left, he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he came back, he didn't know where he had been. Well, now, long before Christopher Columbus, the Southeast Alaskans had money, had a very good knowledge of the principles of money and of economics. They have continued over the years their main occupation, which was fishing. Because of their sense of tradition and their sense of clan and ownership, they developed a very strong sense of it. And to my seeing things, it is no surprise that the first land claims in Alaska came from Southeast Alaska. They have this particular history. They have a sense of ownership. Their habitat, even today, is still dominated by great forests, by mountains, by good streams, and by the sea. And I would say that those are natural resources that, for willing people, even today, can still provide good transportation, good sanitation, good housing, and so forth. So because of these factors, a Southeast Alaskan is much more tradition-oriented. He's much more willing to stay with the past, with his past, as he sees it, as he's been taught to understand his past and his worldview. If you take an Aleut, history, of course, has treated the Aleuts extremely badly. The Russians came into the Aleutian area with the idea of grabbing what there was. That is to say, also after Bering played Columbus for a while. But once they found what there was, they came only with the idea of taking away as much as they could. In other words, as Mr. Marshall pointed out, again, the whole picture of extracting as quickly as possible and then move your carnival show elsewhere. This resulted in a very, very short order in a complete breakdown of their social and economic and political system. You realize that within less than 75 years, the Aleuts had been reduced from an estimated 18,000 to roughly 2,000. Fantastic, drastic change in their population, and therefore, obviously, a fantastic emphasis, necessary emphasis, upon restructuring their whole situation, their whole approach to life. The Aleuts lived in an environment which was extremely rich. When the tide went out, the table was set. Which meant that it was a way of living, really, where young and old could contribute to the food quest, to the economic pursuits. All of this changed in a very short order, and the Aleuts were forced to focus on the new incoming technology and so forth, on the new and incoming approaches to life in order to make a living. Besides that, the Aleuts adopted a new language, Russian. Later on, they learned to forget Russian, to learn English. So today we have people already sometimes two languages away from their original language. But with the adoption of Russian, they also adopted the Orthodox religion, which was a religion and an ideology that was fed by people coming from another country. And very, very often the Aleuts developed outside of the main Alaskan developments because their ideology was fostered and was nourished from Russia. And even today, unless you make a specific effort to bring the Aleuts into the conversation, when people speak of Alaska and the Alaskan problems, they usually forget them. Now, geographically, I know they are on an appendix. But socially and culturally, they were an extremely important group, and they are, and they must be brought into the consideration. They have very, very, very specific problems even today, isolation and so forth. Therefore, it seems to me that the Aleuts lost their very successful approach to life and received for it kind of a generalized way of existence, which was nothing to be especially proud of, but one which was very much tied to the fluctuations of any outside economic changes. And therefore, they lost that self-sufficiency and that strength they used to have prior to the demolition of their culture and their economic setup. When you speak of the interior Athabascan Indians, you have a totally different situation again, where you have people who always lacked these stable, good-sized communities of the two other groups, Southeast Alaska, sea-oriented, the Aleuts, sea-oriented, and even some of the Eskimos, very much sea-oriented. The interior Athabascans are a group of people who seasonally migrated through the interior of Alaska. They had no need for large settlements. They had, therefore, no need for very strong political arrangements. And when they met the newcomers, they met them very much as individuals. Totally different in Southeastern, where the Tlingits met the Russians in force, and were quite willing to even, as you know, chase him out of the fort at Sitka. The interior Athabascan met the newcomer much more as an individual, and the individual who met the newcomer saw that the newcomer brought many ways of doing things which were superior in terms of achieving the work he wanted done. He had better traps, he had better rifles, sometimes better transportation, and the interior Athabascan became quickly enthralled and attached to all these new ways of doing what he had been doing in the past, not realizing that as you begin to adopt new ways, you also begin to make changes in the social and economic and your own social structure way of living. But it is very easy to see why the Athabascan would have been attracted to town life as it was presented. But I submit to you that there are very few villages in the interior of Alaska that you can tell me about that were chosen by native people. They all, practically all, places that were good for a trader, good for a school, good for a mission. They were very often points where distribution took place in the past, and the people came to them in the past only to be for a time and then go back to their traditional, semi-migratory, seasonal activities. They were very good places to be away from. And I submit to you that many of them today are still very good places to be away from. They were never designed by the native people with their needs in mind. I hope the message is coming through. If you do any design now, you better do it with the native people with their needs in mind. In other words, let's have co-determination in any policies you're making. So when you look at the Eskimos, another group, and a large group of our native peoples, you can see that they occupied a very, very extremely large territory in Alaska. And therefore, just simply by the expanse of their territory, they had to be able to adapt to various possibilities. They had to specialize either as caribou hunters, as walrus hunters, seal hunters, as riverine fishermen. And so they really proved to be a very versatile people. At the same time, because of the fairly steady resources that came along, they could also live in communities. again, a different approach to life and to the problem-solving areas of life than the Athabascans. The Eskimos, however, provided a tremendous amount of homogeneity within their culture, and because of the fact that they have been at the geographical fringe of Alaska and in the more inaccessible areas of Alaska, they have also continued more to the present to be true Eskimos. And a true Eskimo for me is not someone who eats muktuk or who wears mukluks. There are many more outsiders now who do that than Eskimos. But the a true Eskimo is someone who has an Eskimo worldview, who has an Eskimo thought pattern and conceptual framework of his family structure, of his interpersonal relationships and so forth, and they have maintained. So just simply in these very, very short thumbnail sketches, you, I think, can see that people in the past, since they had different languages, since they had different habitats, since they had different areas of Alaska, since they had different ways of solving problems, they developed their own particular views of the world, their own value systems, their own approaches to life. Now, when you add to this that there were completely different regional differences in contact history, that contact history in Alaska ranged from 1741, when Bering was in the Aleutians, to, in some places, 1930. Therefore, the contact history is different. Therefore, the people with whom you're dealing are going to have a totally different scale of acculturation. There's also a totally different regional history in Alaska in educational history. Some places schools have existed for 100 years, in other places they are 25 years old. And also different kinds of schools have existed in Alaska. Also regional differences in Alaska with regard to religious history. The regional differences in Alaska with regard to the enmeshment of cash and subsistence economy. In some places they have been in a cash economy for quite a while, in other places it's just beginning, in the full sense of the word. And in no place in rural Alaska is it really fully a cash economy. It is still very much supplemented by a subsistence activity. So I think you can see that what I'm trying to point out is that as we speak today of the Alaska Native, we should not speak of an abstraction. We should speak of a group of people that have a different cultural background, that have different languages, different ways of looking at the world, people that have really, through their isolation in the past and through their magnificent, and I repeat this, through their magnificent adaptation to this harsh environment, they have worked out their own way of solving problems. They have their own view of the world. They have their own interpersonal relationships. They have their own attitudes and values. And it is those people that we must bring, that we must invite into the 1980s, the 1970s. In other words, those are the people that we now say are going to be part of this glorious euphoria that's going through Alaska. I think I agree with Mr. Marshall that the problems will always outweigh the resources. Nevertheless, that does not mean that we should not take a good look at the problems and thereby, by establishing priorities, put the money where the problems are. And that maybe there would be some aspects of Alaska that we could let lie for a while. Alaska, therefore, it seems to me, presents a cultural mosaic. We can't get away from this. Even us, the newcomers, are definitely a mosaic. When others observe even the non-native Alaskans, they have definite ideas about us, and they definitely get the impression that this is not quite the same group as a kind of a homogeneous group in the Midwest of the United States. So since we have this cultural mosaic, and since we have here in Alaska rather an artificial ingathering of people with various cultural backgrounds into one political, administrative, or educational system, it seems to me that Alaska presents some very specific problems in education. And if you're going to see the program, the educational base, and to change one word, for modern Alaska, then it seems to me that we should know something about the implications of a true cross-cultural education. Now, education in the broadest sense, of course, is nothing else but the cultural process. It is just simply the fact that in every culture, in every way of living, among every group of people, there must be devised a way for making them competent members of that particular society. Now, this particular process we anthropologists call enculturation, to become a member of one's culture, to reach competence in that particular culture. Now, this process of enculturation, education, in our society has largely been delegated to the schools and to formal education. And formal education is really the outcome of a very, very long series of changes. But education in other groups where you do not have this emphasis on formal education is much, much more an informal process. It is through storytelling, it is through repeated action, it is through observation, it is through just simply being in this particular group that one absorbs the competence to be a member of that group. Well, now I'm willing to say that very often by the age of 5, 6 years old, that competence, that particular way of looking at the world, that particular feeling of the world is already instilled. We can all ignore it and go merrily in our way, or we can educate and start from where these people are. This is what I mean by saying that we should be aware of cross-cultural education. Because educating across cultures means simply educating members of groups who share norms, values, attitudes, a worldview that's different from that of the person who is doing the educating. It means quite often that teachers and pupils speak a different language. And do not kid yourself, there are literally thousands of Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts who are still speaking a native language, who are speaking their language, who therefore speak a language different from that of the teacher. That means very often that the teachers and the students react differently to similar stimuli, that they see things differently, that they hear one and the same word and react completely differently, that they also see the same object and perceive two radically different realities. Now, that is the educational background that I see when you speak of preparing people to teach cross-culturally. This is the reality. And when we speak in Alaska of cross-cultural education, we should be realistic and face, it seems to me, the very brutal fact that this means, in our situation, the teaching of Euro-American values and norms and attitudes and a worldview to children of Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut cultural backgrounds. Now, it may come as a surprise to some of you that a frequent result of haphazard application of cross-cultural education, especially Euro-American education, has been the creation of ruthless, apathetic, and unproductive people. I could give you examples from all over the world of the creation of ruthless, apathetic, and unproductive people. I'm asking you, that's what we want to do for the next 10 years. In the past, many teachers and formulators of educational policy have been unaware of and or unwilling to adjust their programs to the cultural distinctiveness of the Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts. Many teachers believed that such an adjustment would be inimical to the American way of life, and they were inspired by the false ideal of the great melting pot. Too few understood, it seems to me, that people can be attached to radically different cultural patterns and in fact prefer them to other patterns. Now, this ethnocentrism, this feeling that everything is best in our own particular way, led education, it seems to me, to adopt numerous damaging educational policies which had tremendously destructive effect on native acculturation. And what I'm saying here of Alaska is easily borne out by what has happened with the American Indian in the United States. Now, early education, or early educators of the culturally different, commonly insisted on an almost complete abandonment of Aboriginal cultures. In the name of education, they often demanded that the native student abandon his language, abandon his basic patterns of family organization, various subsistence techniques, religious beliefs and practices that were divergent from Euro-American patterns. And in fact, in the name of education, it has been suggested in Alaska that the native past is a handicap, that it is something that can only hurt him. A student who hears that sort of thing concludes that he is only an imperfect white man, that he does not have a valid culture, that he does not have a valid language, that he does not have a valid history to be proud of. And instead of concluding that he is only different from the next fellow, he concludes that he is inferior. And I see this time and time and again, ladies and gentlemen, at the University of Alaska. If I can only get those youngsters to realize that they are only different, and that in America, it is our greatest pride, I hope, and it certainly should be in Alaska, that we want to achieve the coexistence of articulated differences. That we don't run through the country slashing down anyone who utters or articulates a difference, but that we really are willing to work towards the coexistence of articulated differences, of cultural distinctiveness, and therefore that all we say we are different from each other, we are not inferior one to the other. Then you do not destroy cultural identity. Then you do not introduce all sorts of psychological frictions and psychological problems, and then you are working on a basis that is healthy to impart knowledge. You cannot impart knowledge to someone who stands there completely unsure of himself, not knowing what to do, not knowing who he is, and who thinks that he is creating personal problems for the poor teachers. And therefore who, in order to avoid creating problems for the teachers, just simply withdraws in his shell and says, I can't upset this poor man every day, so he just simply apathetically retracts. All of us who have taught in the bush can testify to these particular situations. So the student who cannot forget that he is an Eskimo or an Indian or an Aleut, either biologically or sociologically or emotionally, or because he has Eskimo or Indian or Aleut parents of whom he's very fond, to whom he's very close, and with whom he wants desperately to identify, this person cannot forget that he is Eskimo, Indian, or Aleut. And yet, if we have this sort of a cultural tyranny, the one culture tyranny, let me call it, if we have that sort of an educational policy of the one culture tyranny, then we are just simply constantly using a damaging emphasis for these people. And we ask this youngster, and whether it is now in the grade school, or in the high school, or even yet at the university, we ask him to do the impossible. We are simply frustrating him. We are teaching him a culture of frustration. And if there is one thing that none of us can live with, that is with constant frustration. In other words, an Aleut, an Indian, an Eskimo, a Belgian like myself, can never be fully what others are. You have grown up in a certain way of living. You have absorbed this. If you know what's going on, you're proud of it. You try to be a bicultural person as much as possible, but in your heart, in the depth of your personality, you remain what your parents made you way back. And I'm not speaking of genetics. I'm speaking of cultural enculturation. And therefore, we have to start, it seems to me, from this particular background, that we do not teach a culture of frustration, but that we start teaching from a realization of what is going on, and from this base begin to build up. Closely related to this particular problem of the cultural tyranny, I think is another problem, and that is the assumption that the value of the educator's life, or the educator's way of life, is self-evident. Usually the educator is a product of middle-class Euro-American homes, Euro-American educational system, and the educator possesses a set of successful life experiences. That's what he brings with him to Alaska. Now, these attitudes are very common in any culture. Any cultural person has these particular attitudes. It's very fine if the teacher and the student are sharing the same experiences and the same worldview. But these assumptions that a teacher's, or that the American, the Euro-American, let's call it the urban American, worldview is self-evident is absolutely ridiculous, it seems to me. That is not by any means self-evident, and to bring that to a group of culturally different students and expect them in grade school or even in kindergarten to take this all in as if it were, well, obviously that's the only natural, good, decent human way to live. Well, I submit that there are many, many different ways of solving certain problems in life, and to assume that they are self-evident seems to me as ridiculous. In fact, I would say that these assumptions are highly maladaptive when working with the culturally different, because many of the basic values that a teacher takes for granted are objectionable in other cultures. The willingness, for instance, to engage openly in competitive verbal exchanges, something we constantly encourage in our schools. Willingness to engage in competitive verbal exchanges. That is objectionable. In fact, it's bad form in an Eskimo group of people. You do not push yourself. You do not stick out. You do not verbally push and fight. You are not overtly aggressive. You would rather walk away than fight. So then we have the teachers who, in a highly competitive methodology, try to encourage games and plays and so forth in the schools. They cannot understand how come there is silence in the classroom. They say, how come Eskimo children don't want to talk? As soon as they step out of the class, they're just full of life. They go all over the place, bring them back in, boom, quiet. There is just simply that is when Eskimos are together, they act like Eskimos. Naturally, how else would they act? And when Eskimos are together, they are egalitarian. They do not push each other. They do not stick out unless in a few culturally approved activities. And I'm just simply now beginning to get the feeling that in the villages, education is becoming to be appreciated as a culturally outstanding activity, something of which one can be proud. And then, of course, you can brag about it. I've even asked my students, and I have about 250 or so teachers teaching in the state of Alaska that I have had the opportunity to teach some anthropology to in order to change some of these attitudes. I have even asked them not to distribute report cards in class for the simple reason that if one is singled out, he will be leveled afterward by the others. But to do it in the traditional way, speak to a third person about the second one while the second one is listening and getting an earful, but you mention it to the third person. Well, now, these are small things, but they, in my view, they are trying to start from the cultural background that is there and lead from there and start from there. The family relationships. We have all heard about Dick and Jane. I came from Belgium. I was brought up in Belgium, and I never heard about these two characters. And even less about Spot. Until I was a fairly mature old man by the time I ever laid eyes on it. And by then I was in the process of developing a new set of readers, which are now used in 41 schools in the state of Alaska, and which we hope, with proper financial backing, which we hope will be extended into all the schools of the state of Alaska as soon as we are aware of the evaluatory techniques and so forth that we will use. I have seen Eskimo children ask, why does Dick and Jane have to go and visit Grandma? Any decent, good grandma lives with her family. Why do these kids have to be helped across the street by a policeman? Kids run across the street in the village 600 times a day and never see a policeman. So just simple little things which we have going on in our system and which I think need eradicating. An Eskimo, for instance, will define visiting as simply to be together. Now, we go and visit somebody. If I don't start talking to John after the first 2 minutes, he's going to worry. But after 5 minutes, he's going to... Well, now, Eskimos have visited me as I was doing my work in the villages, and they just simply want to be with you. Just to be together. It's a wonderful thing. But we have this compulsion to talk. Just simply showing you again the differential emphasis that exists between, let's say, people with this kind of a cultural background or people with ours, where high verbal exchanges are the thing. I won't even go into such things as the whole sublingual situation. Eskimo children, and Athabascan children many times, answer all the questions the teacher asks simply by raising or lowering eyebrows. And the teacher asks it again, and the child answers again, and he answers, asks again, and he asks again. And he said, he must be an awfully stupid person. Because I answer 3 times, and I still get bawled out for not answering. Simply little things, which it seems to me are extremely necessary. Well, there are many other things. Let me give you just one example. The Extension Service has for many years tried to get gardening going in many parts of the state of Alaska. Now, of course, this was based upon the presumption, I guess you can call it that, or the assumption that potatoes are necessary to one's endurance, perpetuation, and so forth and so forth. You see. Well, now, I don't believe that coming from Belgium. So they tried and tried to get those people to grow gardens. Well, now, in some places, gardens caught on because there had been a significant other whether it was a priest or a teacher or a trader or whatever, who grew gardens and it caught on. But in many places, there simply was no taste for these things. But I find that there's a much deeper and a much more profound reason. When you begin to look at the native cultures of Alaska, Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut, you will see that the work in their cultures always had an immediate reward. Now, you talk about people quitting on jobs and all that sort of thing. Work has an immediate reward. You go out hunting, you will come. It may take you 3 days, but you come back with a moose. Or you come back with caribou, or you come back with fish. But this idea of working and working and putting stuff in the ground and looking at it and maybe even going and watering it and keeping the dogs off it and hoping that in September something is coming out is just not part of the culture pattern. And it's the same thing. If you get a paycheck, that is your immediate reward for a task done. The task was 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, you have a paycheck. This business of engaging yourself for years to the same crazy activity and every time get this immediate, while it's not an immediate reward, it's definitely a postponed reward, it does not fit in with the cultural patterns. Well, now, the background, I think, or the problems that I have outlined, you can easily see now with the Alaska scene or in the Alaska scene. We are definitely dealing with people for whom the cultures are still very much alive. Do not kid yourselves. Anthropologists have very, very well proven that much of technology may change, that much of the outside trappings may change, but that the value system, the inner core of a culture, is extremely slow in changing. And therefore, that we better take cognizance of it. Well, for me, it seems from my standpoint as an anthropologist looking at the scene in Alaska, that education in Alaska today, in order to be meaningful for the future, and we have never, I hope, educated people for the past. Education is only meaningful if it gives you a real choice for the future. So since we're obviously educating for the future, because every day the poor kid gets a day older, since we're educating for the future, it seems to me that education in Alaska must present and expand its scope both vertically and horizontally throughout the whole system. By this I mean that vertically it should start younger and end much older. In other words, I want to see in education in Alaska, meaningful education with properly prepared people and so forth, that starts way back at preschool, daycare centers, parent-child centers, Head Start. There is no reason, ladies and gentlemen, there is no reason that in Alaska there are only 40 villages with Head Start, and that there are about 20 others that are running it sort of on their own, and who have to do it without guidance, without instructional counseling and so forth. And the fact that the people are willing to pay for it themselves shows that they appreciate the value, that they see what is going on, what it does for the youngsters. Head Start, extremely important. Then the work in the grade schools, the work in the high schools, university, and adult education. As long as we do not engage in adult education throughout the state of Alaska, we will be constantly keeping one group of people with one value system, passing it down to children to whom we are passing on a different value system. And unless we get the older people at least acquainted with our value system. And therefore, I see in Alaska also that we have a dual educational duty, not just simply to teach skills, but we must also teach values. I submit to you that it doesn't make a bit of sense to me to teach someone a technical skill when he does not have the motivation to exercise it. When he cannot see why he ought to be a welder, or why he ought to be a computer technician. And of course, while I'm on that subject, that if we get any vocational schools going, please let's not go back to building little houses and little carpentry stuffs when the whole future is going to be technologically so sophisticated. Let's start in the high schools by teaching vocational courses that have relevance to the future, not to 19th century, John was talking about this, to 19th century life. So we must make changes, drastic changes, which means that we have to involve the older people, advisory councils, extremely necessary as an educational process for the older people in order to exert their influence on the younger ones. Teacher aides, who themselves in time will become teachers, in other words, the program that's now being talked about and being organized, the Teacher Corps program. Teacher aides because they have bilingual capabilities. They can teach certain things. I'm not speaking of teaching Eskimo, Indian, or Aleut necessarily to people who may already have partly forgotten it. But I'm speaking of people who can use the language and who can teach certain subjects of the day, certain parts of the day, in the child's language, so that the child is not confronted with two drastically difficult situations. One, that he does not understand the language, and two, that he doesn't understand the concept that the language is trying to convey. So teacher aids, it seems to me. Then another category is the whole business of boarding schools, regional schools, again, in order to somehow or other keep the children, keep the youngsters, keep the high school students a little closer to the world that they're going to live in. It's fine to go to Shamalwa and it's fine to go to Chilaco, but it is not quite Alaska, isn't it? And secondly, you cannot provide them there with the opportunities and with the occasions to see the new Alaska developing. It's pretty difficult to see this in Chamawa, you know, or in Chilaco, or even sometimes in Mount Edgecombe. So regional high schools are extremely important, again, because of the vertical change that I see, the new direction that is required. Then I think it seems to me that the time has really come to start using native resource personnel in all our schools, I don't care what level. Persons who can, by the fact that they are qualified. Now, I'm not saying take any person who is Eskimo, Indian, or Aleut and say, teach your culture, just like I cannot take any one of you and say, teach English, or teach psychology, or teach this or that. Nevertheless, there are people who have a special expertise and who can contribute that expertise to the youngsters. Now, why do I ask for all these changes? And one change, which I hope you as people planning policy, why are there schools in Alaska, including boarding schools in Alaska, standing empty in the summer and not being used for enrichment programs? We have an upward bound program going on at the University of Alaska. I think it is one of the most marvelous things that happened to high school education in Alaska the last 3-4 years. Same thing at AMU. Why is there not an upward bound program going full blast at Bell's in Nome? Why is there not one going on at Copper Valley School? I don't care whether it's a denominational school. It's a building. We can put people in there. We can provide opportunities. Or St. Mary's on the Lower Yukon. Or Mount Edgecombe. Any place where we can have enrichment programs, we should be putting them. Because we have people who have characteristically been processed to an educational system that left them with 2 or 3 or 4 year inadequacies at the end. They must be recaptured one way or another in order to compete with the world that we all want to put them in. And then finally, I repeat once again, we should have education for the adults. Now, the horizontal change that I would like to see is curriculum changes. Culturally relevant materials are extremely important. We have made a start, as I said, by developing the Alaskan readers, and from all reports, they are doing extremely well. The youngsters are taken to them. There is nothing in those readers that is not found within the cultural environment of the youngster. Not one thing. It's ruthlessly kept out. There are no diction chains, no skyscrapers for the first several books and so forth. Because it is difficult enough to learn how to read without trying to figure out what you're reading about. Just the simple concept is this. Now, why did that take so many years to somehow or other catch on and take hold? So culturally relevant materials. Now, by this, I also mean that it's high time that we start developing some sort of a course to be taught to the youngsters when they start leaving the villages, come in contact with others, and have to ask themselves for the first time often, who am I in relation to him? It's a crisis period, ladies and gentlemen. It is very often at that moment when the identity crisis sets in. It's the first time that he's forced to identify himself and he has nothing to identify himself with. We have not given him any Alaska history. I do not believe that Alaska history started in 1741. I can prove it to you it didn't. But then why don't we teach it? Why don't we teach these people about their own magnificent cultural adaptation to the past? Why do we not have courses which somehow or other bolster the identity of the youngsters? In other words, in the high schools in Alaska, there should be a required course to be taken not only by the Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut, but also by the non-native, because there is a mutual peer education that's necessary to teach the cultural background of as well the past as the present Because I submit to you, if you are an Eskimo only because you look like a Japanese, it's a sad situation. And yet, I forced 85 youngsters at Nome to finally admit to me that's the only reason they could give me, because they were not eating muktuk, they were not wearing muklucks, they were not speaking Eskimo. But if they had been able to give me a tremendous pride in their past, a knowledge of the past, a healthy knowledge of the past, and so forth, they would have said, we are Alaskans of Eskimo extraction, and this is what it means. But I will wear any shoes I want. I will go to any school I want. I will go to any place of economic opportunity I want, whether it's the village, if that suits me. I have been reading in the papers about your group here being willing to perpetuate, or at least to safeguard, a peculiar Alaskan lifestyle, whatever that is. Nevertheless, we feel that Alaska has a lifestyle which makes it peculiarly its own. Well, if Alaskans, the non-native Alaskans, have a lifestyle which they want to perpetuate, please allow the others also to have a lifestyle which they may want to perpetuate. And that if Alaska is going to mean anything, it will have to be an incorporation, a coexistence of these articulated lifestyles. Not the one culture tyranny, but simply that we will have to be willing to look upon this. Another horizontal change that must take place is the teacher's professional development. There is no reason, again, it seems to me, except a financial one, it seems, and we have solved that now, so everybody says. There is no reason why the several hundred new teachers coming to the state of Alaska every year, green as grass from the state of Kentucky, or not as blue as grass from the state of Kentucky, never been in the state of Alaska, never been in Anchorage, and they're already baffled when they get to Anchorage, when they get to Fairbanks. But then they go out from there to the villages, and yet here they are going to teach these culturally different people. Now, why can there not be some sort of an orientation? I don't mean 3 days about fixing generators. I mean a week or so of really some solid acquaintance with the culture. Because I find that you may not understand everything, but if you have an echo, when you see cultural activities and they have a response in you, you will be much less ethnocentric, in other words, much less ready to condemn, to wipe out, and so forth. You may even learn something. And you know, teachers who learn, or rather, a highly prized person, so to think. So it seems to me that we must really provide an orientation situation for all these people who are entering every year by the hundreds new employment in rural Alaska. We must do this, it seems to me. So, ladies and gentlemen, these vertical and horizontal changes that I would like to see against the cultural background of our native Alaskans, and with an understanding of their background, are desperately needed, it seems to me. We need changes in educational goals. We need changes in curriculum. We need changes in teaching strategy. And this is where Mr. Marshall made references to the media. We hear a lot about satellites floating around up there, unused and so forth. But certainly the time has come, it seems to me, to start utilizing the most modern, technologically up-to-date machinery in order to teach in the rural areas. And we also need changes in the administrative structure of the schools of Alaska. And without this sort, it seems to me, of educational base, there will not be a modern Alaska for its first citizens. There will not be, it seems to me, either, a full participation in the good life that we wish for all of Alaskans. And the time has come, it seems to me, to do something about providing equal co-determination, equal participation in the educational policymaking, so that there will be equal opportunity and equal choice and equal happiness for the true first Alaskans. And this, it seems to me, must start with flexible education. And the time is now, and only you can do it. Thank you.